Usually when we set out to help someone, our instinct is to shine this massive blinding spotlight directly on them.
Right,
Like if a kid is struggling, if they're acting out, we point that beam of light right at their behavior. We ask, what's wrong with you? Or if we're maybe a bit more informed, what happened to you?
Exactly. The focus is entirely outward.
But our focus, yeah, it's always outward. And you, our listener, you've shared your sources with us because you want to get to the bottom of trauma-informed care without getting bogged down in the textbook slog. You want the deep
The
knowledge.
actual mechanics of how it works.
Right, the mechanics. And that brings us to the core of today's deep dive. Because when you look at the research, suddenly you're told to take that giant spotlight, turn it 180 degrees, and point it directly at a mirror.
Which is such a massive
It
shift.
really is. So today we're diving into Chapter 7 of the User-Oriented Guidelines from the TIPI for Kids initiative. And TIPI stands for Trauma-Informed Practice, just so we're clear. This chapter focuses heavily on enhancing the self-awareness and self-perception of teachers, youth workers, and parents. So our mission today is to figure out why effectively helping someone else, especially a traumatized young person, actually starts with you staring at your own reflection.
It is a profound paradigm shift, really. It challenges the fundamental mechanics of what we assume caregiving is.
How so?
Well, we naturally think of caregiving as this outward flow of energy and expertise, right? But these guidelines argue something far more complex. Working with youth who have experienced trauma requires way more than just professional knowledge or technical skills.
Okay, so the degrees don't cut it.
Right. You can have all the degrees on your wall, but if you lack a deep awareness of your own emotions, your own reactions, and your own values, you are essentially flying blind.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's get into the mechanics of that. Because the text goes really deep into the why. It brings up researcher Daniel Siegel's work from 2012, highlighting how uncontrolled emotional reactions or, projecting your own experiences can unintentionally harm trauma survivors.
Unintentionally being the key word there.
Yeah, exactly. The text points out that caregivers inevitably bring their personal histories into their interactions. It makes me think of language translation.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, so imagine you're a translator for two people who don't speak the same language. Your job is to pass the message back and forth accurately, right?
Right.
But if you have your own strong, unexamined opinions about the topic they're discussing, you might start unconsciously changing the words.
Right, you color the translation.
Yes, you inject your own bias, add a little extra anger, or maybe soften a blow that wasn't meant to be softened. You can't truly translate what the other person is feeling if your own internal noise is too loud.
The translation analogy works really well here, but we need to recognize that the stakes are infinitely higher in caregiving because a bad translation in this context registers as a physical threat to a child's nervous system.
Wow, a literal physical threat.
Authentic empathy actually requires a solid foundation of self-awareness. Without it, adults project rather than perceive. The biological mechanism at play here is pattern recognition.
Okay, explain that a bit more.
So your brain is essentially a prediction machine. You think you are reacting objectively to a child's sudden anger, but your brain is actually like pulling up a file from your own past.
Like your own father's anger, maybe.
Exactly. You aren't seeing the child in front of you anymore. You are reacting to a ghost. And a traumatized child whose nervous system is already hypersensitized to any signs of danger feels that disconnect. They perceive it as an immediate threat.
Which brings us to a really chilling example in the guidelines about how we misjudge complex behaviors when we lack that self-awareness. Let's look at the mechanics of dissociation.
Right, this is a crucial part of the text.
When a child experiences severe trauma, one of the most common coping mechanisms is to dissociate, to mentally check out, go numb, and just withdraw because the present reality is too overwhelming to process.
It's a survival tactic.
But outwardly, to an untrained adult, a dissociating child just looks like they're ignoring you. They look bored or actively defiant. Like you're the teacher, you ask a question, and the kid just stares right through you.
And if you lack self-awareness in that moment, you process their neurological freeze response through your own unexamined emotional filter.
And your filter might dictate, hey, this child is disrespecting my authority.
Exactly. Because your ego feels threatened, your stress levels rise, and you instinctively express frustration or anger. You reprimand them.
But we're completely missing the underlying causality here.
Completely. The child isn't being defiant. Their nervous system is literally offline. Your frustrated reaction doesn't teach them respect. It simply re-traumatizes them. It confirms their deeply held trauma-induced belief that the world is unsafe and adults are inherently unpredictable.
Man, that is a stark look at how our own emotional filters can completely warp reality. It turns a moment where a kid desperately needs a lifeline into a moment of punishment.
It's heartbreaking, really.
It is. But the fallout from an unexamined mind doesn't just harm the child. The guidelines dive heavily into the toll this takes on the caregiver, too. They talk about secondary traumatic stress, or STS, pulling from Figley's research back in 1995.
Yeah, STS is a major occupational hazard.
And the early warning signs of STS are so insidious. Emotional, numbing, irritability, and just profound fatigue. But I want to push back on this a little, or at least look at how deeply counterintuitive it is.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, you go into this line of work teaching social work parenting because you care intensely. Yet, the act of intensely caring for and helping traumatized people can result in you becoming completely emotionally numb. Doesn't that seem backwards?
It seems like a paradox until you examine the biology of empathy. I mean, empathy isn't just a philosophical concept. It requires us to neurologically simulate the pain of others so we can understand it.
So our brains are literally mirroring their pain.
Right. Your mirror neurons are firing. When you are constantly simulating the severe, complex trauma of children day in and day out, your own nervous system absorbs that shock. It gets overloaded. The emotional numbing described by Figley isn't a sudden loss of compassion. It is a desperate biological defense mechanism.
Oh, wow. It's like a circuit breaker tripping to prevent an electrical fire.
That's a perfect way to describe it.
The breaker doesn't trip because it hates electricity. It trips because the system is overwhelmed and it's just trying to save the house.
Exactly.
Think about your own professional life for everyone listening right now. How often does burnout masquerade as irritability for you? You snap at a colleague, you're completely exhausted by small tasks, and you think, oh, I just need a long weekend to catch up on sleep.
But actually, your emotional circuit breaker has tripped.
Right. Because you've been absorbing the ambient stress of your environment without a grounding mechanism.
And that happens constantly. This is why self-awareness is critical. It acts as the smoke detector before the fire. It helps individuals monitor those physiological and emotional states before they completely derail their work or their relationships.
Yeah.
The guidelines make it very clear that an adult who cannot recognize their own secondary trauma becomes an active liability in a trauma-sensitive environment.
Okay, so what does this all mean in practice? Because knowing you have a blind spot doesn't automatically fix it. Once you realize you're susceptible to secondary trauma and projection, how do you actively debug your own emotional reactions?
Well, the text makes it clear that self-awareness isn't a fixed personality trait. You aren't just born enlightened.
Thank goodness.
Right. It's a dynamic, ongoing process, a muscle that must be continuously exercised. And they highlight a few specific methods, starting with mindfulness.
Yeah, they cite Kabat-Zinn from 2005, noting that even short daily mindfulness exercises drastically improve attention, emotion regulation, and something they call interpersonal attunement.
Interpersonal attunement is a crucial term here. In this context, we really need to strip the word mindfulness of its pop culture baggage.
So no chanting on a yoga mat required.
I mean, you can if you want, but no, it's not about achieving a state of Zen bliss. Mechanically, mindfulness is the rigorous practice of observing your own thoughts and physical sensations without immediately acting on them.
Okay.
It is creating a microsecond of space between a child's triggering action and your reaction. In that microsecond, you are bypassing your amygdala, the fear center of the brain, and engaging your prefrontal cortex.
Which is the logical part.
Right. That allows you to actually attune to the child's needs rather than reacting defensively to your own discomfort.
That makes a lot of sense.
Wow.
The guidelines also lean heavily into reflective journaling, but they position it as much more than just a, like, dear diary record of events.
Oh, absolutely. It's very analytical.
They frame it as a targeted tool to track emotional patterns and notice recurring triggers. Again, it's like debugging a complex computer program. You are the programmer, and journaling is how you review your own source code.
I love that analogy.
You are looking for the hidden line of code that says, if a child rolls their eyes, execute protocol. Extreme anger. You have to find that bug, figure out when it was written, and rewrite it.
Journaling provides the raw data you need for that rewrite. You are analyzing past responses to engineer more effective future strategies. However, the text emphasizes a critical limitation to solo reflection.
Right, because we can't do it all alone.
Exactly. They bring up Fuch and Gardner from 2007 regarding the absolute necessity of supervision and structured discussion with colleagues or other parents. You cannot debug your own programming entirely on your own.
Because sometimes you've been staring at the computer screen for so many hours that you physically cannot see the typo in your own code. You just become blind to it.
Yes. You have to bring in a second programmer to look at it with fresh eyes. Supervision provides that external perspective to eliminate your blind spots.
But implementing that raises a massive systemic issue, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
You cannot have honest, vulnerable discussions about your emotional failures if you are afraid of being judged, penalized, or fired.
Right.
Cultivating this level of self-awareness requires a deep culture of psychological safety. Educational institutions and youth organizations frequently fail here.
Yeah, they demand trauma-informed care from their staff, but maintain really punitive management styles.
Exactly. The guidelines stress that institutions must actively foster an environment where a teacher can say to a supervisor, "I am feeling irrationally angry at this student and my circuit breaker is tripping," without any fear of retribution.
That systemic support is vital. And here's where it gets really interesting. Once you have that mirror in place through mindfulness, journaling, safe supervision, you hit another hurdle. We have to look at how our newly clarified self-perception interacts with the deeply damaged self-perception of a traumatized child.
Because trauma fundamentally distorts how a child views themselves.
Yeah. The guidelines note that they often internalize intense guilt. They genuinely believe they are responsible for the terrible things that happened to them. They feel helpless, and they consider themselves completely unworthy of care and attention.
And this internal distortion dictates their external behavior. The psychiatrist Judith Herman, whose work from 1997 is cited here, explains how this damaged self-perception manifests. A child might actively reject praise.
Reject praise? Like how?
Well, you might tell them they did a brilliant job on an assignment and they immediately rip it up. Or they simply refuse to trust you, no matter how consistent and kind you are.
Which is incredibly confusing and frustrating for an adult who is just trying their best to be supportive. Like, why are you ripping up the painting I just complimented?
It is frustrating until you understand the concept of cognitive dissonance at play.
Okay, lay that out for us.
If a child's core trauma-forged belief is, "I am worthless and unsafe," and you introduce a new variable by saying you are wonderful and safe, those two realities cannot coexist.
Oh, wow.
The conflict creates cognitive dissonance, which the child's brain registers as a threat. Ripping up the artwork is their way of restoring order to their internal universe.
That is wild.
Herman's work shows that when an adult recognizes this behavior as a manifestation of a damaged self-perception rather than intentional defiance, it changes the entire dynamic. It allows the adult to bypass a punitive response and maintain a supportive presence.
You start to see the pain driving the behavior, not just the behavior itself. But the guidelines drop a massive condition here. Caregivers have to process their own past traumatic experiences to do this successfully.
Yes, that's non-negotiable.
Because if they don't, they will unconsciously replicate patterns from their own childhoods. And we aren't just talking about severe headline-making abuse. We're talking about the minor emotional bruises, the unexamined baggage we all carry around.
The subtle stuff.
Yeah. If you grew up in a household where love was strictly conditional on your performance, the text suggests you might unconsciously withhold warmth from a struggling student until they get a passing grade, completely replicating your own childhood trauma.
It is the unavoidable reality of human interaction. Unprocessed history dictates present behavior. Supporting children requires caregivers to first map their own emotional architecture.
So this makes me want to push back a little bit. If unexamined trauma always replicates itself, does this mean teachers, youth workers, and parents have to be perfectly 100% healed to help a kid?
That's a great question.
Because, I mean, do we have to be enlightened gurus with zero emotional baggage before we can step foot in the classroom or try to parent a struggling child? Because if that's the standard, we're going to have a severe shortage of qualified adults.
It really is the million-dollar question. And the answer is no, you do not have to be perfectly healed. In fact, waiting for perfect healing is a trap.
Oh, good. That's a relief.
What the research actually demands is resilience. The text cites Southwick and Charney from 2012, emphasizing that resilience isn't the absence of trauma or the eradication of triggers. It's the ability to adapt positively to adversity. Self-awareness doesn't magically cure you of your past.
Right.
It simply stops your past from operating the steering wheel in secret.
Ah, so it's the act of reflection.
Okay.
It's knowing the trigger is there, seeing it clearly in the mirror, rather than pretending it doesn't exist.
Precisely that. When adults are actively aware of their own emotional limits and triggers, they can model healthy regulation for the children. You can show a child, hey, I get overwhelmed too, and here's how I take a moment to breathe and handle it.
That's so powerful.
It is. That authentic display of resilience is far more powerful and instructive to a traumatized brain than pretending to be a flawless, unbothered robot.
Right. But doing all of this active reflection, processing your own childhood baggage, constantly scanning your nervous system for triggers, simulating the complex trauma of the kids you're trying to help, and dealing with their cognitive dissonance that requires a massive caloric and emotional burn.
It is exhausting work.
Which brings us to how we sustain this. The guidelines are unequivocal. Self-care is not a luxury. It is a professional and ethical necessity in a trauma-sensitive environment.
It is emotionally demanding in a way that fundamentally alters your physiology. Society often markets self-care as, like, consumerism, a frivolous spa day, a bubble bath, an expensive vacation. But these guidelines reframe self-care entirely.
They treat it more like putting on Kevlar armor before walking to a blast zone.
Exactly.
You are entering an emotionally hazardous environment. You wouldn't walk into a blast zone in a t-shirt, and you can't walk into trauma-informed care without rigorous psychological armor.
The practical self-care they outline is demanding. It includes establishing firm, unapologetic boundaries to prevent the emotional exhaustion we discussed earlier.
Right, the circuit breaker.
Yes. It includes physical maintenance, too. Sleep, proper nutrition, and exercise aren't lifestyle choices here. They are biological prerequisites for emotional regulation. And it involves rigorous mental hygiene, whether that is therapy, creative expression, or simply dedicating time to physically process difficult emotions rather than swallowing them.
They also emphasize connection, right? That social support and close non-work relationships physically mitigate the effects of cortisol and stress.
They do, yes.
But they also call out the systemic failure of institutions again. They cite Neffen Germer from 2018, affirming that teachers and parents who engage in this level of self-care are the ones who can actually create an emotionally safe environment for kids. But it can't just be on the individual teacher to meditate their way out of a broken system.
No, the burden can't just be on the individual.
The institutions themselves have to promote work-life balance and provide access to mental health resources.
Because prioritizing your own mental well-being is not selfish. It is the prerequisite for the work. Without that Kevlar, without the rigorous maintenance of your own nervous system, the empathy degrades into secondary traumatic stress. You become numb, and you lose the very capacity that makes you effective.
It's the ultimate oxygen mask principle. You have to secure your own mask before assisting the person next to you. If you pass out from lack of oxygen, your good intentions mean absolutely nothing.
The overarching theme of these guidelines is that the responsibility of the caregiver is dual-directional. The internal work of self-awareness and self-care is just as vital and just as professional as the external work of behavioral intervention.
So as we pull these threads together, the journey we've taken through these sources is profound. We started by dismantling the idea that helping others is purely about technical skills. Those skills fall flat without the bedrock of self-awareness. We explore the mechanics of how an unexamined emotional filter leads us to misinterpret neurological freeze responses as defiance, causing profound harm and leading directly to our own burnout. We saw how cognitive dissonance makes traumatized youth reject the very praise they need, and we learned that prioritizing your own mental hygiene isn't a selfish act. It is the very engine that powers authentic empathy, prevents secondary trauma, and builds resilience.
It forces us to confront our own humanity before we try to fix someone else's.
It really does. And I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over. We spent this time focused heavily on the formal guidelines for teachers, youth workers, and parents dealing with traumatized kids. But, you know, human psychology doesn't clock out at 5 p.m.
No, the brain's pattern recognition software runs 24/7.
Right. So if unexamined past experiences and minor hidden traumas unconsciously shape an adult's daily responses to vulnerable children, well, how might your own hidden emotional triggers be secretly writing the script for your everyday interactions right now?
It's a huge question.
How is your unexamined history subtly shaping your arguments with your partner, your patience with your friends, or your instinctive reactions to your colleagues without you even knowing it?
We are all constantly projecting our histories onto the present moment. The question is simply whether we choose to see it.
So the next time you find yourself wanting to shine that blinding spotlight on someone else's behavior, wondering what's wrong with them, maybe take a deep breath. Flip that spotlight 180 degrees and see what the mirror has to tell you first.